Welcome to the Combat Learning Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Josh Peacock. If you're new, please join the free newsletter at combatlearning.com/newsletter. You get some great free goodies and you'll never miss an episode of the podcast. If you're an existing fan of Combat Learning, I have an important announcement to make right after the introduction. Today, I joined Brian Willis on a podcast series he does for his police training website, the Excellence in Training Academy. Brian has over 25 years of full-time police officer experience and now 25 years of experience as a police trainer as well. He consults with trainers and training agencies through his consulting company, Winning Mind Training. Links to both websites are included in the description. Brian invited me on his show to talk about my scalable live training framework and 3D model of coaching. He did such a great job structuring this interview that it functions as a great introduction to both concepts. While most of my analogies are combat sports oriented, I do make some explicit connections and examples around how this framework works for defensive tactics and especially firearms training. Now, on to the big announcement before I put you into the show. I mentioned way back in the end of season 3 that I was going to start monetizing the podcast. I've been extremely slow about putting anything firm in place. However, after torturing over it for a while, I've made some strategic decisions about my content and I'm opening two avenues for you to support the podcast. Firstly, I've decided that for the time being, I will not be gating any content behind a paywall. I made this choice for the sake of spreading the ecological approach as fast and as far as I possibly can right now by providing premium content for anybody to access anywhere at any time without the friction of buying a course or articles or anything like that. Because nothing I produce is directly monetized, the only thing I can gate is my time. More on that in a second. The first way to support is called Buy Me a Coffee. This is a donation platform. Since I've made the decision to only gatekeep my time, there is no special content available here. It's just to support the show if you've enjoyed and benefited from the content, and I greatly appreciate it. You can find that by going to combatlearning.com/support. The second way to support is through Zoom workshops. If you're a coach trying to navigate the ecological approach for your program, you can join these workshops to get direct access to me and also collaborate with other ecological practitioners to solve problems on your mat and in your program design. Go to combatlearning.com/waitlist, wait is W-A-I-T, to get on the waitlist for these workshops. There are only 10 spots in the first cohort, so don't wait around. If you join the waitlist late, you'll be placed in line for the next cohort. So whether you sign up the day this podcast releases or weeks afterwards, don't wait because it's first come, first serve. If you want to be on the second cohort, you should not dilly-dally on this at all. And you should also not dilly-dally because if you wait too long, you might not get into any cohort at all because I do not have infinite time yet to dedicate to these workshops. So this takes time out of my weeks, out of my months, hours. So if you want to get in one of these workshops, be quick. All right. If you're excited to jump in, hit the subscribe button on your podcatcher and enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Excellence in Training Academy, where trainers come to grow at excellenceintrainingacademy.com. I'm very pleased to have with us this week, Josh Peacock. Josh is the host of the Combat Learning Podcast. He is a lifelong martial arts fanatic with over 20 years in the game, including over 8 years as an instructor. Josh currently holds a fourth dan in Taekwondo and a blue belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and has some experience in most styles widely available today. His love for teaching and learning martial arts led Josh to earn a master's degree in teaching and learning. So Josh, welcome to the Excellence Training Academy.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, I first saw you when you were one of the roundtables with Perception Action Podcast, and you were on there with Sean Mishka and Rafe Kelly and Scott Seavright, and talking about the ecological dynamics approach to martial arts training. And I've listened to a few of the episodes of your Combat Learning Podcast. And then you sent out an email recently, and I'd heard you mention this briefly on one of your podcasts about your 3D model of coaching. And that's what I wanted to talk about today. But this 3D model of coaching is part of a framework that you have, an SLT, which is scalable live training. So can you talk about briefly about that scalable live training framework and what it is and how you developed it?
Yeah, so scalable live training is, it's basically, the basic premise of it is that you can do live training, like more, think of something like sparring, 100% of the time from day one, safely and productively. So that is the basic premise or the basic claim of scalable live training. People who get into it and maybe read the introduction posts and understand about it will recognize that it's a translation and an extension of the constraints-led approach to motor learning. But the problem with the constraints-led approach and things around ecological dynamics are all very related, is the jargon. It's just the terminology is very difficult.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of terminologies.
Yes.
There's terminologies that's very much attached to ecological dynamics. And then there's sort of the constraints-led approach has some terms that belong to it. And, so all those things are very confusing. So what I thought I would do is I would translate everything into terms that are more understandable to martial artists. So, with scalable live training, there's three main principles of it. It starts with challenge point. And a challenge point is the point at which a person needs to be challenged in order to grow. If there's too much challenge, they will be hindered in their growth. And if there's too little challenge, obviously they're not being pushed to grow anymore. And that challenge point, of course, is really the amount of complexity or the amount of aliveness that a person can handle. So if you have a day one beginner, the amount of aliveness that they can handle and still learn is going to be much lower than if somebody is an elite athlete and they might actually need a lot of enhanced complexity that's even beyond the sport itself. So that's where the scalability part of the scalable live training comes in. We want to take the aliveness and we never want it to be dead. We never want it to be not alive. We want to scale it down. And so there's two main levers of scaling within the scalable live training framework. And that is task simplification, which comes straight from constraints-led approach, and intensity control. And so task simplification, basically to take any sort of exercise and make sure that it's always alive, but simple to deal with. And an example of that would be, you could, in jiu-jitsu, for example, you could do a pass sweep game where the top player has to pass the legs of the bottom player and establish a side mount position. And the bottom player has to keep the top player from doing that, but in order to win, sweep the person. Now, some people might be, for day one, might be able to play a game like that. But for a lot of people, it's really difficult. And it's going to be really, really frustrating. So a way to simplify that would be to take away some of the other parts of it. So you could focus in on staying upright. So the bottom player, all the bottom player has to do is try to sweep the top player. And the top player, all he has to do is stay upright. And so some of the complexity of trying to get past the legs and fight for underhooks and establish a mount, all of those things are sort of removed and they have less to focus on, but it's still alive. So that's an example of task simplification. The other thing, intensity control. Intensity control, there's three ways to do it. You can do what I call effort cueing, which is really just to remind people to stop, you know, spazzing out so much or going so hard. That doesn't work that well, but sometimes it is necessary. One that I like better is using time constraints. So if you have a smaller amount of time, people are going to exert more effort to try and get their task goal completed. Whereas if they have more time, they understand that they're going to be expending too much energy, so they become more judicious with the energy expenditure, and so they naturally sort of scale their energy expenditure down or their intensity down. I've even heard some people remove time constraint entirely. So there is no visible, you have no idea how much time you have. And they've said that's also kind of kept the intensity level down. And then finally, you have partner matching, and that can help you with intensity control as well. So that is the scalable live training framework in a nutshell. And the 3D model of coaching, of course, is really important as part of that.
So when we talk about this, a great explanation, and that scalability is we can scale as the learners advance their abilities, but you can scale it depending on, you might have a class with people of different levels of experience that you could scale it for them. And you talked about the live part, and you talked about aliveness. And for people that haven't listened to some of the interviews with, say, Sean Mishka or Tyler Yerby, where they talked about the importance of aliveness, that live piece is meaning that they're interacting, they're involved with an opponent right from the start, as opposed to doing a bunch of isolated static drills by themselves. Right. They're interacting with an opponent immediately. Is that what you're talking about with the live and the aliveness piece?
Yes. So I define aliveness in a very particular way. There are several different definitions of it, but for me, there are two key features or key dynamics that always have to be together in order for it to be considered alive, and that is unscripted and uncooperative. Those are the key features of a live exercise. And the reason that is the case is because no matter what the rules are, no matter what the environment is like, a competition, or you can take this to self-defense or anything else, really. People that you interact with, opponents that you interact with, are always going to be self-determined. They're creating the moves. They're controlling their movements. And they're always going to be antagonistic. So they're uncooperative. And so everything has to be unscripted, uncooperative, so that you, and this is kind of jumping back up the ecological dynamics, so that you have to key in on the right information sources to help you control action across different types of scenarios, instead of relying on something like the sequence of movements. If you memorize the sequence of movements, you're focused on movement A, B, C, D, and you're not necessarily focused on something like how is my shoulder chassis moving? What's going on with my core? What's going on with my hips? These are things that people that are fighting, and also people that are police officers, anyone who ends up in a self-defense situation, they're monitoring body language, certain aspects of the body, to understand how a person is going to act, what they're moving towards in the moment. Whereas if you do something like one-step sparring or a drill that's very sequenced, your body automatically keys in onto the most predictable piece of information to understand what's going on. And if it's sequenced, then you're automatically going to key in on the sequence. You're not going to key in on the other important pieces of information for action. And uncooperative, that one's very intuitive. If the person's just compliant, then you're not really, nothing you try on them is necessarily going to work. And it changes the whole dynamic of the movement. So trying to throw somebody who's not resisting is entirely different than trying to throw somebody who is resisting. Almost everything changes about it.
Excellent. That's a critical piece, because a lot of times we do a lot of that rote repetition with really a cooperative partner. There's minor resistance, but it's scripted. I think your jiu-jitsu example was a great example, is that both the person on the top, person on the bottom have a goal. So they're both, they're working towards their goal, but what they do to accomplish that is unscripted, but they're also dealing with an uncooperative subject who's trying to defeat what they're doing. And so they're learning to read those cues. So I love those key pieces. Now, one of the things that in your blog post where you talked about your 3D model is you said that in this scalable live training, coaches are no longer primarily operating as instructors, knowledge transfer agents, or biomechanical feedback providers. Can you talk about that, the shifting role of the coaches, and talk about the fact that you're not suggesting that coaches aren't important, that they don't play a key role, but their role shifts in this. So can you talk about that?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And so the traditional idea of a coach or an instructor is that there's a very hierarchical relationship, even in terms of knowledge. I think there's still a hierarchical relationship in the constraints-led approach and ecological approach. A lot of the people say that there isn't, but the coach is obviously in a place of guidance, and the learners are being guided. But that's beside the point. What's happening here is, instead of me saying, I have all the answers to the problems that show up in your training, I'm actually saying, I'm going to facilitate these realistic training scenarios, or these games, and I'm going to help you find your own solutions to these problems. Now, some of them will look just like everybody else, because there are things that whenever you have a sort of environment, there are invariant features, and then there are features that change. But a lot of them will be very unique to the person. And so, instead of stepping in and saying, you know what, you need to know all these solutions, you need to know all these combinations, and then every time you find yourself in a recurrent problem, like while rolling or striking or sparring, I give you one or two discrete solutions to these things and expect you to do it X, Y, Z, A, B, C, just so. I'm actually going to help you understand how to analyze the problem and explore ways that you can actually solve that problem, get solutions to that problem. So the coach becomes more like a guide to help you discover things for yourself, rather than a encyclopedia of knowledge that just hands you solutions every time you run into a problem. I actually, as a scalable live training coach, or a 3D coach rather, I actually want you to fail sometimes. In fact, I want you to fail as often as you can, as long as your motivation is not taking a bad hit, so that you can have repeat exposure to a problem and try different things. If we go back to the ecological dynamics research, in sort of the nonlinear pedagogical approach, nonlinear pedagogy is just like constraints-led approach. They borrow a lot of concepts from each other. If you discover solutions on your own, and it's still on your own, even though you have a little bit of guidance from a coach, the learning is, and the retention is much more permanent. It's much more impactful. And your adaptability is higher because you tried all these different things and they weren't working. And so during this time, your attention is being finely tuned towards the information from your opponent that you need to focus on in order to organize your body to the right solution. And once you find it, it clicks, and you can't get rid of it because of the way that you found the solution, rather than it being handed to you. And everybody who's ever taught before, they know that when they hand a solution to a student, they have them do the repetition or whatever, you might see it emerge in sparring once or twice, but it never seems to actually solve the problem. It's always a lot of, you give it to them and they try it and it doesn't work, or maybe it does work, but then it stops working. And there's just a constant feedback. That's where the feedback thing comes from. The biomechanical feedback provider idea is that we just give so much copious amounts of detailed instruction about how kids should move their body or how adults should move their body. And not really, we don't help them with where they should focus on, or the task or the effect that they should be working towards creating.
Absolutely. And a couple of things that jump out at me is, number one is that a lot of times the solutions that we're giving them are our solutions. They work for us based on our size, our strength, mm-hmm. our skill level. So if I'm a brand new practitioner in Taekwondo and you're a fourth dan, there's a huge gap there. And if you're giving me solutions that work for you, then there's no way they're going to work for me. Now, just to clarify one piece before we get to jump into the 3D model of coaching, I think sometimes people misunderstand the piece around failing. And that this is not about setting people up mm-hmm. to fail. It's about creating environments where they're training at the outer edges of their skill level. Some of that challenge point theory from Lee and others a long time ago, so that they're going to struggle, but mm-hmm. the struggle is good. Struggle is helpful. So you're not talking about setting them up for failure. You're talking about that it's okay to fail and it's okay to struggle in working through to find solutions, correct?
Absolutely. And the discrepancies between different different attempts at a problem, at solving a problem, those little discrepancies are necessary to learning. Everything about your perceptual system relies on slight discrepancies in order to perceive. Your eyes are always moving. You have slight movements in your eyes. They never just fixate on one place. In fact, if you do find yourself fixating on a point, the point disappears. So there has to be slight movements in your eyes in order for you to perceive things clearly. So you need those discrepancies in order to learn. If you don't have them, if you sterilize the environment too much, then you're not really learning.
Excellent. So the 3D model of coaching is design, direct, dissect. So design, practice, direct attention, dissect mm-hmm. performance. So let's talk about the first D, the design piece. So what are some of the key elements? I think you talked about one of the keys in there about that when we're designing this, that the training activities must be both unscripted and uncooperative. What are some of the other elements in the design piece? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you want the other two elements are realism and the design variables that you can manipulate. I think I call them manipulatives. If you remember from learning math as a kid, I used what we called manipulatives, and they were just like little pieces you can move around and do it 2 + 2 = 4 and all that kind of stuff. I guess just to make math seem more concrete, that's what I think of when I call them manipulatives. But realism is, this is one of those translations of terms. So in ecological dynamics, this is called representative learning design. And the key features of aliveness are part of that. But there are other features, such as the training environment, the ring, the coach, the referee, the rules, anything you can think of that is a part of the performance environment, that can be a part of representative. Now, representativeness or the realism. Now, it's impossible to have all of those things present in every training exercise. We don't always have a crowd. We don't always have the same equipment or scoreboard or anything like that. We don't always have, in terms of a police environment, we don't always have a realistic street environment, or, you know, police find themselves in novel situations all the time that you can't always train for. Yep. So you can't always have those things there, but you want there to be enough crossover that it still has transfer to those novel environments, to navigating those novel environments. And there's no hard and fast rule for that, but you always have to have the unscripted, uncooperative element, in my opinion. And then you always want to have the rules and in anything else you can add in there safely and reliably to training.
So when you talk about representative learning design, when you talk about representative learning design, you're talking about giving the learner an experience that realistically simulates the actual experience, but in small slices, correct? Like, you're not looking to replicate the entire event, that this is one piece of it, but it would be realistic that they could imagine that how this would play out in a real world environment.
Yes, absolutely. And the purpose of the slices is so that when we call like a rote repetition sequence, we'll often call that a drill, right? We want to be able to drill down on parts of a skill set so that we can focus on shoring up the strength of that skill set. But we can't do it by an actual rote drill. So the way that we do it is by manipulating the rules of the task parameters and the environment in such a way that we can focus on that situation. Also, it's also a part of the whole sequence of task simplification to task complexification. So a lot of those, I call them middle slices. They're more like something you would think of out of a technical sparring match or a partial scenario or a positional sparring type of game. This is more of like a middle slice of the game. There's a lot you could do, but you can't play the entire game. This is on the way to the full thing, which would be sparring according to the rules of the performance environment. Or in police work, I'm not entirely sure what this would equate to because I've never been through the police scenario training, but I'm sure that there are established scenarios that are considered like the full thing.
Right.
This is something you are going to deal with in your line as a police officer, and you need to be able to manage this situation in its fullness. You're working your way up through those, but you can also use them to shore up individual skills that contribute to dealing with the entire scenario.
Excellent. And absolutely. And trainers, people that are listening would understand that we're working towards that high fidelity scenario-based training, reality-based training, but that we need to build do this in a progressive manner, in that scalable manner as you talked about. Now, there's a couple things to go back to that you mentioned. So you mentioned simplification to complexity. Now, I think people, yeah. Just to make sure that people don't misunderstand simplification for you saying you need to break this down into the little pieces and practice each piece on its own, you're taking away some of the elements and Professor Chris Cushion talked about this as well. But can you talk about what you mean by the simplification to complexity?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I've been putting a lot of thought into shooting specifically. And I actually had a friend, we got into it because he's into the scalable live training, but not for shooting so much. He thinks you have to do all this trigger work and stuff before you start managing shooting at a moving opponent and these sorts of things. And so an example that would be really relevant to police work would be where shooting training or shooting somebody who's posing a lethal threat to you or to people around you is understanding how simple can you go with that before the aliveness breaks. In my opinion, if you're in a exercise, let's call it like a tool or drill, where the person is moving at you and you have to fire one or two shots into that person before they reach you with an implement of some sort or they touch you. That would, for me, that's about as simple as you can go before the aliveness is broken. If you're shooting on the range at a target that doesn't move, or even at a target that does move, but does not behave like a human, to me, that's sterilized. That's not helpful for the skill of stopping a moving aggressor. And so the most simple version of that task for me would be the gun is drawn already and the person is running at you. Now, if you want to complexify that, you can put the gun in the holster, and now you have to manage the complexity of drawing while the person is running at you. Other ways you can complexify it and continue to scale it up is you can have the person run at you from different angles and directions, or not in a straight line. So they can move in different ways and to actually frustrate your ability to shoot at them and help them get to you before you can fire, you know, 2 or 3 shots into the body. And those are ways to complexify it. And then you can start to add in people, because in real life, sometimes there are bystanders and you don't want to shoot bystanders. And so you just start adding elements. And you can add the room, you can add the environment, you can, I even thought of a way that you could do something for like maybe an active shooter situation in a building, in a workplace environment or a church, where you're all the way up into a scenario that's so complex that there are tasks that keep your attention off of the entryways, because in the exercise, you know that there's going to be an active shooter. Like, you know that they're going to come in somewhere. So you randomize the entry points. You keep people's attention actively off of the attention point, which is more like being in a church service or working, right? Because you probably don't know that there's about to be an active shooter. You randomize the time. So there's like a 5 to 10 minute window when the shooter can enter, and you don't know when that is. It's random every single time. And then you have bystanders engaged in other tasks that could put them in your line of fire when the active shooter enters. So there's all this complexity that's going on in this sort of in-state scenario or reality-based scenario that you have to manage. But if you throw somebody into that immediately, they're going to fail 9 times out of 10. If you stick them with a simunition arm or like a high, I don't know how realistic a high fidelity airsoft replica would be, but it's probably more feasible than buying a simunition firearm. But if you put them that, they're probably going to accidentally shoot themselves or shoot somebody else or just shoot nothing because they can't track a moving target, because the situation is just too complex for them to manage. And so you start from the base skill, which is shoot at a moving target. Then you complexify it in a way that makes the behavior of a moving target more realistic to like an active shooter or any other sort of situation where they can change directions and go towards different targets. And then you add people in, bystanders that you have to navigate because you can't shoot them. And then you keep complexifying it from there.
Excellent. And I think from a firearms training perspective, and this is something we're starting to explore more and more, is that there's some of this that we can do without necessarily live fire, where we can use cert pistols that have a laser that projects so you know where your rounds would be hitting. Mm-hmm. Then we can use airsoft. So the advantage to airsoft over, say, FX marking cartridges by simunition is you don't need as much protective equipment. The higher the velocity of the projectile, the more protective equipment people need. The more protective equipment people need, then you don't see the facial expression, some of the body movements, and some of the other elements. So great explanation there. Now, the other term that you used and that I think we need to make sure that we're paying attention to is transfer. Do these skills transfer to real world environments? And I think, as you know, I've heard you talk about, I think martial arts instructors get frustrated when they see people in tournaments or live sparring and they're not using the things that they allegedly were taught in the practice. We see this a lot where trainers get frustrated with people because they're not using what they allegedly was taught. Is that one of the keys to some of this, the making it realistic, making it alive, the representative nature, is how those abilities to solve problems in new and novel and complex situations, those abilities are going to transfer to a real world environment?
Yeah, that is 100% the premise behind engaging in live training all the time. When you're out doing police work, nobody's on a script. I mean, you can call certain things a monkey dance and say it's, you know, a script. That's a different kind of thing. Nobody is out there behaving in the way that is scripted, in the way that you might find in very scripted scenario situation or in a drill. Things just don't happen like that in real life. And so when you're training, if you want, one of the assumptions of scalable live training, and this is borne out in the research on, from the ecological side of things, is that variability and instability in the practice environment, and that variability and instability needs to be representative, right? It needs to be realistic. So it has to be with elements related to the performance environment. When you practice in those types of environments that are unstable and variable, the transfer, even though the performance in the moment looks rougher than it would be if you were doing repetitions and drills, the transfer to performance environment is much stronger. The adaptability across other situations is generally better. And the skill level moves up. I'm hesitate to say permanently, but you don't see a lot of performance decrement after you find yourself at a level of skill at that level. Whereas with reps and drills, performance is up and down and up and down and up and down. You see people one day they have great technique, the next day it's hurting for some reason, and it's difficult to know why that's the case. There's something called the performance learning paradox, and that is that people always exhibit better form under immediate feedback. But that performance gain is illusory. It's transient. When you come back to the next practice or the next two practices, that performance gain is gone. They're not performing at that level again anymore. And so the ecological dynamics account for why that is the case, is that movement, the form of your movement, the technique, is really drawn to the information that you perceive. And so if I present a particular movement problem to you in sparring or in a scenario situation, I'm pairing movements to that movement to solve it. And as I get better at pairing movements, I start to realize what works and what doesn't work. Then I get more attuned to those information movement pairings. And my form gets better as a result of solving the problem by perceiving that information. And so if that information isn't there, in the case of reps and drilling, that information was the coach. I was giving you information, like lots of information constraints. I was giving you detailed feedback and instruction. The coach isn't there when you're doing the sparring match or the drill or the performance.
Right.
And so you either end up in a hole where you never stop cueing and instructing, or you help the person navigate the environment itself in a way where they actually become more self-sufficient as learners, and they pair. Their form gets better by pairing it to the right information, solving those problems rather than listening to what the coach is saying.
Excellent. And that's such an important point that's come up before about not confusing performance in the moment with learning. Learning can be mm-hmm. ugly and take a while, and it's a protracted exercise. Right. So the first D is design practice. And those, you talked about the exercise design variables, rules, time, practice, environment, equipment, training partner. So the next piece is direct attention. Mm-hmm. So, and you've talked a little bit about attunement. And so in your description of direct attention, you talk about that this requires attunement of learners' attentional focus. So talk about the importance of that, and I think we've heard this term educating attention before. So talk about the importance of that mm-hmm. attunement, what you mean by attunement of a learner's attentional focus.
Absolutely. That's a perfect segue from what I was just talking about, because learning is in part finding the right information in the environment. You're searching and finding and locating the right information in the environment, and that information informs the way that you move. And so instead of giving students step A, one, B, C, D, or one, two, three, these are the solutions. When this person does this, then you do this. And it's like an encyclopedia of stimulus response. Instead of that, we try to help them focus where they need to perceive, where they need to focus their attention on in the environment. Most of that is going to be on the opponent, right? So when I talk about the environment, that includes the opponent. And in the case of a fight, most of that information is coming from the opponent. So with directing the attention, we're helping them focus on where they need to focus in order to find the information to solve their problems. Now, the problem with that is, you know, as kickboxing instructors, as jujitsu instructors, we have a general understanding of where you need to look or where you need to focus sometimes to help you. But we don't know exactly what information variables a given person is using to solve their problems. It is different from person to person. So while they might be looking in the same general region, maybe around the shoulders if they're a boxer, maybe around the midsection or the hips if they're a Taekwondo athlete, we don't know. They could be focusing on one shoulder. They could be focusing on the sternum. They could be focusing on, the core, the solar plexus or something. It depends. Your eye moves around. Your eye moves around to find the information, and some people find information in different places. So what we can do to help people is to focus their attention on the task and on the effect. Now, an effect is really, what is it that you, within the task, what is it that you want to do to solve the task requirement? If you're in a Taekwondo match, for example, you need to hit a legal target area with a legal striking service hard enough to register a point. That is an effect. And so if I want to help a Taekwondo athlete perform a round kick to score, then instead of going through the traditional mode of chambering, lift your leg, turn it, make sure the hips are over the other hip, make sure that the leg is pivoted this way or that way, extend it, bring it back, put it down, which sort of looks like a real round kick, but is not really how people actually perform round kicks in competition. Instead of going through all that, which keeps their attention on their body, on the way it's moving, you would cue them by saying, smash the legal target area, which would be the top of the foot, the top instep. Smash the instep, the top instep, into the hogu, which is the chest gear. Because it's not possible to score without eventually turning your hips over and creating a horizontal trajectory, the constraints of the kick itself will require that the person trying to learn to score with that part of the body will require that they eventually find their way into the proper round kick form. And so that's an example of using constraints or the intrinsic constraints to help a certain behavior emerge in order to fulfill a task requirement. Does that explain it?
Yeah, and it's helping them to understand how to learn over time, how to separate the signal from the noise, what signals are important, and again, it's going to depend on the environment, mm-hmm. the range, the proximity. So there's a whole number of things here. Now, you touched a little bit on this, but you talk about internal versus external focus of control. So can you explain the difference between internal and external focus of control, mm-hmm. And elaborate on which of those is going to be generally more helpful or more important for them?
Absolutely. An internal focus of attention is directing the learner's attention onto the body and how the body is moving. Most coaching, most instruction is internal by default. Everyone does it. I did it a ton. It's just the way people have been sort of trained and socialized into instructing and coaching. I think it's kind of intuitive too, because the first thing you notice when you start to become an instructor, you use yourself, you use your body, your own movement as a sort of standard. And that's what you start to teach to other people. So it is kind of intuitive too. The problem with this is that the focus of attention literature is really strong in showing, that an internal focus of attention actively frustrates performance and leads to choking. So if you've ever seen somebody doing like a field goal kick or a free throw or something, and they've done it so many times, are so good at it, they have such a good success rate in practice, but for some reason in the game at the last moment when it really counted, they choked up. That's usually related to being too focused on what their body's doing and not focused on the task or the effect. And so the task or the effect, that's an external focus of attention. Now, external focus of attention can go, there's a spectrum. If you can manage it, it's probably best not to reference the body. But sometimes with the example with the Taekwondo kick is kind of impossible. So you want to be as away from you want to be as least detailed as possible. So we talk about the legal striking surface. Here's what you do with it. You want to keep the focus on slapping or popping the chest gear. That's the effect we're looking for. Pop the chest gear. Now you have to reference the striking surface because that's the skill we're practicing. And that's a skill that's really pertinent to scoring in the game. But we're not talking about the knee and the hip and the base leg and the trunk. So, if you can get away with not referencing the body, that's awesome. It's not possible a lot. So you want to be as least detailed as possible and really stick to what am I doing with the limb? How does it help me towards the task requirement? So an example with handling a gun, there's some focus of attention literature that found that focusing on the hand and the wrist and the finger, what it's doing, actively detracts from shooting performance. And so you'll hear instructors talk all day long about trigger pull and how that affects your accuracy, which is probably true. But the way to resolve that, according to the research literature, is not to focus the attention on the finger per se or on the hand position per se, but to focus on direct their attention on the target. In the research paper I saw, they talked about using the gun too, like the actual barrel. And these things helped with, I don't remember the exact cues, but these things helped with performance. They were able to shoot better and the transfer was better. So they were able to maintain the performance gain in their accuracy longer than when they were focused on the finger, the hand position, the shoulder, the stance. As you have them repeat exposure to the different problems they need to solve in shooting, they will, and you keep their attention on the right effect, a lot of those problems will start to work themselves out over time without being explicitly cued on what you're doing with the finger, what you're doing with the hand. Now, for safety, this is an exception. If you have somebody walking around in an environment with their finger on the trigger of a gun and they're not pointing down the range just to shoot, you have to tell them, keep your finger off the trigger. that is in a situation where cueing them on what they're doing with their body is really important, because they need to be aware of what their body is doing for that specific task of being safe. But in terms of performing when you're shooting live rounds, their attention needs to be on the gun, but probably on the target more so. And you can switch between cues. You don't have to do just one. You can move between more than one. But you don't want to do too many, because that research paper that I cited before, they found that people trying to focus on more than two tasks were really having a hard time performing well when they were shooting. So you don't want to do too many. You can go maybe in progressive, start on one thing, and then once you see a performance, you can use a different cue. But the external focus of attention most of the time leads to better performance and learning. Internal focus of attention usually leads to frustrated performance and weaker learning. There probably are situations where you can use internal cueing. From what I've seen, Dr. Rob Gray's talked about this before, it seems to be more with people who are expert performers. There is some benefit of focusing more on the minutia of what their body's doing. But I don't know if that could be a part of the practice environment. I don't think that you would coach or cue a performer in competition or in the moment that way, because it could still lead to a temporary performance deficit.
And one of the other key elements for law enforcement that's different from a lot of domains is the decision-making component. And so the value of that external focus of control is it allows you to process that information and be interacting with the information, which may change where if I have too much of an internal focus, I may miss critical information in the environment. So great explanation. And again, that external focus of control. So we've talked about design. We've talked about direct. So then post-performance, and this also, I guess, you might use some elements of this during the practice, is the dissect performance. So can you talk about what you mean by dissection? Are you talking about reflection after action review, dissecting what we did so that we can enhance future performance?
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing that you could do during practice, and it works after practice too, is questioning. And so if somebody, as a coach, you use the questioning method. If somebody's having a problem in an exercise, for example, maybe they're having trouble escaping back mount. Somebody is on their back and they're controlling them really well and they just can't get out. You can stop and then you can start to ask the person struggling questions to understand what they're feeling and the problems they're running into. And so questioning, if you come from a traditional instruction mindset, it's easy to start asking closed-ended questions that very definitively lead them to one solution. And if that's what you're doing, then you should just give them the solution. We want to be open-ended. The first thing we want to do is actually understand what it is they're feeling. The problem I've run into with coaches, and I did this too as a coach, is that I assumed too much what was going on because I'm looking from a third-person perspective. And I know that what someone sees from a third-person perspective does not always represent what the person is feeling in the moment, because as an athlete myself in jiu-jitsu and in taekwondo, there were times when the coach was barking at me to do something that I knew I couldn't do from where I was. Either I was too fatigued or I was in a position where a joint was compromised. And if I would have done what the coach was barking at me to do, I very likely would have gotten injured or I wouldn't have been able to maintain it, whatever it was. And so it's really important that you start with very broad open-ended questions about what they're feeling, what they're perceiving, what's causing them not to be able to escape. And so this cues them, you get to understand what's going on so you don't make any assumptions as you try to help them. But you also cue the learner to start thinking in terms about what they're learning or what they're perceiving or what they're experiencing that it's not so cloudy. Now it's like, you know, sometimes when you're rolling or when you're engaged in a really intense scenario, everything's kind of cloudy and it's overwhelming. But if you help a learner recall and unpack what it is they're perceiving, and if it's really intense, they might not be able to remember everything, and that's totally normal. But normal sparring matches, normally they can remember what they were doing. It doesn't seem so overwhelming or scary anymore. Okay, there's these specific problems. Okay, this arm's here. I can't move this arm. This hip's stuck. You know, I can't. If I move this arm, this comes in. So now they start to, now I'm starting to locate the issues, which is going to prime the attention of what they need to be looking out for when they start practicing it. And then you funnel your way down. Okay, so here's the problem here. What do you think you can do to stop this from happening, or to move this arm, or to clear this limb? And you'll be surprised that a lot of your learners can actually start coming up with workable things. They don't need your input on technique to come up with something that might work. And then you have them go back at it, and you let them go through it, and maybe it won't work, or they'll need to adjust it. That's how live practice works. Sometimes things you dream up in your head just don't happen the way you thought they would, and you have to adjust them. Totally normal.
So is part of this, sorry to interrupt you, but is part of this,
step in.
Is part of this going back to the directing attention? So asking them, focus, get them to focus on, okay, so what was your goal? What were you attempting to accomplish? What were you perceiving? What did that mean to you? And so where was your attention? What were you attending to? And take them back to that so that they're starting to, they're going back to that external focus of control. This is what I was attempting to accomplish. This was what I was experiencing. This is what I was paying attention to. This is what it meant to me. And then I got stuck here. I couldn't figure out how to solve this problem. So are we linking this back to the directing the attention piece?
Yes, absolutely. It should be, if you're doing it well, most of your questions should help the learner focus his attention back off onto the opponent, onto the environment and the information, and not so much on what he's doing with his body. Now, again, like I said before, sometimes it's impossible. Sometimes it is useful to the person to understand what they're doing with a part of their body. An example of that would be, a lot of times people that are actually doing back control, they lose track of what they're doing. And so because it feels more secure, they will cross their ankles from the back because it feels like they can control the opponent better, which can lead them to get their foot broken pretty easily if the person lifts their leg and drops it on it. So you might want to step in and draw attention to what they're doing with their feet. Now, will that hurt performance? It might. But we kind of had to do that for the sake of safety. But in most situations, you don't have to do that. And after you've done a few rounds of trying to hold back control, that problem will start to disappear because you'll start to realize that actually crossing your ankles doesn't control an opponent the way you need it to in order to facilitate a submission or a transition. But for the most, like for 90% of it, it really should help the person focus on what the opponent is doing and the effects that they can use to clear those problems for themselves. Yes.
Excellent. So we can use questioning during the session. And again, this is not constant interruption and questioning. It's a very intentional, deliberate use of it after a round. Or again, we may step in if there's a safety issue. So we're using questioning. Reflection is another critical piece. But well, the third element, so you talk about questioning, reflection, and playback analysis. So the use of video. So I think what we have both historically seen is when we look at the video, the video is all coach-centered. The coach telling, see, you did this wrong. You should have done this. You did this wrong. So talk about more effective use of video from the playback analysis standpoint on how, as a coach, you would use this effectively to enhance the performer's learning and self-directed learning.
Right. So the whole dissection phase, the dissect performance part, it's all meant to help create self-sufficient learners. That's why we come in and start questioning them, because it helps them to calibrate their own attention and to start experiencing and engaging in their own problem-solving processes. Reflection is a big part of that. We can use question to induce reflection after the practice, so they think about what went right and what went wrong, and they can start to think of action plans on how to practice. We actually want them to become self-sufficient learners. So with playback analysis, we start with the coach analyzing a lot. But the coach can, again, use questioning and reflection to help direct the learner's attention on what he's seeing in his own performance in the video, so that he can look at his own performance from a third-person perspective as if he were his own coach, and identify things that he does well and things he doesn't do well, and then come up with action plans to maintain performance and improve performance. Within scalable live training, obviously we want this to be contextualized as live exercise interventions. We want them to come up with scalable live training games that they can use to help shore up these issues, and not repetitions and drills. So it is different than a lot of other people use playback analysis. But we want the instructor to start teaching the learner the information he's looking at when he's evaluating performance, so that the learner can start to evaluate it that way too and become self-sufficient. And in the process, you know, if you're a very competitive coach, or you are a police instructor who's looking to build up the next generation of police instructors, you actually embed coach training into the learning process early. And so now you have people who are more able and competent to eventually step into that role when they are experienced enough. That's a secondary effect of it. The primary effect is we actually just want them to be better performers. But a nice part of making them into self-sufficient learners is they can more easily become very competent, very skilled coaches. That's something I really like about it.
Excellent. And they can become self-coaches, which I think is a critical piece of a lot of what you talk about. Yep. Now, just to wrap up here, one of the things that you talk about in that your post about the 3D model of coaching is, or it may have been in one of your other posts, where you talk about how you define learning is a little different from most people. And you talk about three elements. Learning is an improved ability to find and use relevant environmental information to control your movement. Learning is a stable, improved ability to solve sport-specific movement problems in the moment by pairing an effective movement to that information source. And learning is an ability to adapt a tactic on the fly to unique circumstances of a match to accomplish a sport-specific goal. So just talk briefly about that framework around how you assess learning, that it's not the ability to replicate an exact technique in a sterile environment, but this is about real-world performance, it sounds like.
It absolutely is. All three of those steps is meant to exclude artificial modes of measurement. And so what I hear a lot, that people will push back on the things that I teach, and they'll say, well, you know, I did this and my technique got better. And then you ask them a few questions, and what they actually mean is, I did wall kicking, or I did air kicking, or I did this, I did the chamber steps. And what it led to was a better ability to perform the chamber steps fast, or on a target that doesn't move, you know, on a paddle. And so the measurement is insufficient. Of course, doing repetitions or doing drills will lead to you doing repetitions and drills better. That is a closed environment. And it's not an accurate measurement of how you will perform in a variable, chaotic, unstable environment, which is what most performance, police work, service work, any sort of contact with the public, or your retail worker, any of that. It's not going to transfer those environments, because at least not well. Maybe eventually a little bit of it will. It's not going to transfer well to those environments because they're more complex. And so when you measure it that way, it's a false positive. So going back to the performance learning paradox, learning is not something, you can't open up somebody's brain, pull out a file and check, oh, if this person learned XYZ. Learning is inferential. Understanding if learning has taken place is inferential in nature. So I have to look at your performance to infer if learning has taken place. If performance is often illusory, if it's transient, if I give you instructions and you have a performance gain, and then you come back to next practice and the performance gain is gone, did learning ever take place? I say no. Learning is a relatively stable change. And in the context of a live environment, that implies always adaptability. So learning, according to the scalable live training and 3D model, is a stable improvement in your ability to read the opponent and engage in functional movement responses to that. You're not always going to be perfect. You're going to make mistakes, but there will be a noticeable increase in your ability to manage that complexity in ways that are functional and productive, rather than just always failing or being totally shut down or unable to manage that. And so you have to measure that by observing a person over longer time scales and in a representative, realistic environment, not in a sterile environment. So there's a mismatch in measurement there.
Excellent. And I think the other piece of the representative learning design, and we talked to Keith Davids about this when we talked about nonlinear pedagogy, is the representative testing design as well, that we need to test them in representative environments, which is exactly mm-hmm. what you're talking about. So talk a little bit about combat learning. So you have a podcast, you have a blog. So let people know about what that is and how they can access that and how they get more information and follow you or reach out to you.
Absolutely. So combat learning, it's a podcast that's been around for about 3 years now. It is dedicated solely to perceptual motor learning, skill acquisition, skill adaptation for martial arts and combat sports. We talk a lot about self-defense, which probably overlaps some with what police officers do. But most of it is really, especially in recent years, is really sport focused. But the principles of learning and the principles of a practice design apply everywhere. They apply across the board. So you can find the blog. I am very slow to write and publish blogs, but you can find all that at combatlearning.com, and the podcast is available on every conceivable podcatcher.
And I think even if people aren't martial artists, there's a lot that you can glean, because you interview martial artists from around the world, from a whole variety of different styles of martial arts. Mm-hmm. And they're at different places with their teaching journey. So some have been using some of these principles for a long time. Mm-hmm. Some are very new in that, and they're talking about the lessons learned. But again, I think there's a lot that people can learn from teaching physical skills, from a skill acquisition, skill adaptation format, from listening to the people that you interview. And you interview people like Ian Renshaw, who co-wrote Nonlinear Pedagogy, the book with Keith Davids, but also was the lead author on the book on constraint-led approach, and you interview him about that. So there's a lot that people mm-hmm. can take away. And you have some deeper dives into the 3D model and into the SLT framework as well in your, if they go to your website and go on your blogs, correct?
Absolutely, yes.
And is that the best way for people to reach out to you as well? Do you post on other on social media platforms, or people go on there and just click on the contact link if they want to connect with you or reach out to you?
I want to be more active on social in the future. I want to put more on YouTube and more on Instagram. If you reach out to me on Instagram, it should be at Combat Learning. I do see that. I do check that every once in a while, and I'll reply to you. The best way to reach out to me is either through combatlearning.com or at my email address for Combat Learning, which is Josh, J-O-S-H, at combatlearning.com.
Excellent. Well, Josh, I want to really thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to do the interview. But more importantly, I want to thank you for all the great information that you shared, not only during this interview, but for all the important things that you do through Combat Learning, through the blog posts, through your podcast, to get this information out there. And I know you've been interviewed on a number of other podcasts, and you're continuing to do a great job of help us to take these general frameworks, set some of the complex language aside, and let's look at the principles and concepts that we can apply to enhance learning for our people. So for all of that, for everything you have done and everything you continue to do, thank you so much for all of your contributions and your commitment and your passion in this area.
You are so welcome. Thank you for saying all those kind words. And thank you for having me on. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks so much for listening to the Combat Learning Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or your podcatcher of choice. It really helps us out. Finally, this episode, including the intro music, is produced by Micah Peacock. Thanks in advance, and I'll see you on the next episode.